Steve, you've heard about LitFest, right?
Yes.
Are you do make appearances at that? Have you before?
I never have. No.
All of the, there you were as the principal video editor, reviewer for...
Well, really a big deal, a national figure when it comes to literature.
And... Well, you kind of have been, yeah. And you're well-read. I think you would be perfect at that. Eric Zorn, Mary Schmeek, all of our friends at the Tribune, a lot of them do that sort of thing. I would think you would be a good one to do one of those author interviews or talks.
Thank you, but I think it came close a couple years ago and it fell through.
Robert Kersen's in our studio right now. His latest book is Rocket Men.
Well, I'd want to interview Robert Kersen if I could.
I know. Well, he's sitting right here. Let's do that. Robert, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
We read Crashing Through. We read Shadow Divers. Now Rocket Men is your telling of the story of Apollo 8. You're going to be at LitFest too, right?
That's right, on Sunday.
Are you giving a self-talk or is somebody interviewing you on stage?
I'm going to be interviewed by the legendary Rick Kogan.
Oh, that'll be great. I'll preview you for it right now. We'll start at the Billy Goat.
Spot on.
What inspired you to write about Apollo 8? I think when people think about America's manned space flights, they think about Gemini, Mercury, they think about Apollo 13. How did Apollo 8 appear on your radar?
It was a totally happy accident. I was at the Museum of Science and Industry showing friends the U-505, the U-boat, which is a perfect match for the one I wrote about in my first book, Shadow Divers, which tells the story of a lost German U-boat in New Jersey waters. And as I was wandering out, you could get lost very easily in the Museum of Science and Industry. And I took a left instead of a right and found myself in the Henry Crown Space Center. And there is this space capsule that looks at once to have come from the past and the future. And I look at the placard and it says, this is Apollo 8, man's first journey to the moon. And I knew nothing about it. And I like space. I knew about Apollo 11, which is the first landing, and Apollo 13, in which an explosion in an oxygen tank makes a near tragedy for the crew. But I knew nothing about man's first journey away from home and first arrival at a new world. I went home, I did some research, and in 15 or 20 minutes, I knew I was looking at the greatest space story ever told.
Why?
Well, part of it was because so much was done for the first time. I remember listening to an interview with Neil Armstrong when I first got home, and he spoke in near reverential tones about Apollo 8 in a way he didn't even speak about Apollo 11. And one of the points he stressed was that Apollo 8 was sent to the launch pad, conceived and put on the launch pad in 4 months, not the usual 12 to 18 months. And it was for very dramatic, fascinating reasons. But he said, you know, by the time we went on Apollo 11, so much of what we did was already proven. But when Apollo 8 went, nobody knew that any of it could really be done.
Including with the rocket work.
That's right. They're going to go on the Saturn V rocket. It's the only rocket powerful enough to carry human beings to the moon. And yet, the Saturn V had only flown twice before Apollo 8, both times unmanned. And in the second of those tests, it was a near disaster of failures.
So I know, let's put some guys on there and send them to the moon.
Not just guys, but guys with children and wives, and not just with children and wives, but at Christmas, at the end of 1968, probably one of the worst years in our country's history. So this was incredibly dramatic from the first moment it was conceived.
And they tried to be sensitive to that. That is, oh yeah, they'll be doing this at Christmas time in 1968. Will that look as a political ploy? They were actually wondering if it would be conceived that way.
That's right. Chris Kraft, the master...
Perceived that way, yeah.
Yes. Chris Kraft, who was the mastermind of mission control and a real NASA legend, worried that it would be viewed as a political stunt. But he said it wasn't politics that dictated the Christmas flight. It was nature. And so they had to obey the laws of the universe, and that's when the launch window opened.
Yeah. But it was politics that maybe forced the issue. That is, if I understand correctly, we're in the middle of a Cold War with the Soviet Union. And we send a spaceship up, they send a spaceship up. They send a manned flight up, we send a manned flight up. They send a dog up, et cetera, et cetera. They got to the moon before we did, right?
Well, they have two flights in 1968 that go around the moon. They're both unmanned, but it looks for all the world like they are ready to send the first men around the moon. And that's a huge deal. Space is viewed as a huge military imperative. The first country that could send men into space could build space stations, put soldiers in space.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Because that was the imperative, but do you think that It was necessary for those reasons to be first in space?
I think it was a huge psychological component to that. But also, if you won the space race by delivering the first men to the moon, that's a huge argument in favor of your way of life, your brand of science, and your political structure. So it's a huge propaganda issue for both sides in this existential space race that's going on.
I don't know. In retrospect, it just seemed to me to be a little, silly's not the right word, but wrong-headed. That is, we don't have space soldiers. We aren't using satellites to deliver weapons, that it mattered politically. Maybe the national pride was at stake. But the idea that we've got to get in space first because maybe we'll control the space and therefore have a military advantage, I don't know. Was that borne out? Is that true?
Well, I don't know. Once Apollo 8 proved that it could be done, and then we followed on with Apollo 11 and the subsequent Apollo flights, the space race was pretty much over and we had won. So we don't really know how it would have played out that way. And certainly no one's ever been back since then. But it was a huge and devastating blow to the Soviet Union in terms of the argument for whose political system is right, whose scientific approach is right, and everything else. So I think it was a grave, dealt a grave damaging blow to them.
So they do it in 4 months' time?
4 months from conception to liftoff.
And that was a tough sell in Washington, wasn't it?
Very tough, because in January of 1967, not even 2 years earlier, NASA had lost three brave astronauts on the launch pad during a test for Apollo 1. That itself almost doomed the Apollo program. And to risk another three lives here could easily have ended the space program. And yet here they're going to do it, and they're going to do it faster than anyone thought humanly possible.
Were the astronauts enthusiastic?
Very much so. Frank Borman accepted the, he's the commander, he accepted the change in mission on the spot. He didn't consult his crewmates, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders.
Or his wife.
Or the other wives. He just said yes. But Borman viewed the entire space program and the mission to get men to the moon as a military one. He was there at NASA for one reason and one reason only, and that was to defeat the Soviets on the ultimate battlefield, space.
So they get the rockets built. They get the computers coded properly, et cetera, and then the ship lifts off. How does the mission go?
Well, even in the first moments, Bill Anders thinks the mission is going terribly. Despite having the ultimate world-class state-of-the-art simulators that hoped to simulate the violence of a Saturn V launch, it came nowhere close. It couldn't touch it. It was a baby
test
simulator.
Test one, two, three. Compared.
Standby, standby.
Hey, this isn't working.
There we go. That's another studio. Keep talking. Yeah. So the shaking in the capsule was so violent, they didn't anticipate that.
They had no idea. In fact, Bill Anders believed that the rocket's fins were being shorn off by the launch tower. It was so crazy and so violent, they all lost control of their limbs. They couldn't see the instruments. The only thing Anders really detected was Borman taking his hand off the abort handle. And Borman will tell you, I would have rather died than abort in a mistake. And he means it literally. He would have rather died. So they are riding this no matter what. And it lifts off much more slowly than the other faster rockets they used in the Gemini program.
It was so heavy.
So heavy and so much power. The power of a small atomic bomb underneath them.
Huh. So it lifts off. The one stage separates. The other stage separates. Was there any concern that they would generate enough velocity to escape the Earth's gravity? Or did they know that if the rockets survived, that they would be able to blast off to the moon?
Yeah, they felt very confident. They're going to go into Earth orbit for about 90 minutes to make sure everything's okay, but they have to relight the third stage engine. But they believe if that lights, they can gain enough momentum from around 17,400 miles an hour to near 25,000 miles an hour to escape Earth's gravity.
I love, too, was it Borman who was all business?
Yes.
And so they say, okay, great. So we're going to be up there. And then the PR guys go, we'll have you do a couple of TV specials right from space. What was his reaction to that?
Well, he was flat out against it. He wanted, and by the way, their plan is to orbit 10 times around the moon. He wanted to orbit once. He thought that was enough to put a final nail in the Soviet coffin in the space race, and that's all they needed to do. But NASA really wanted to learn everything there was about making a manned lunar flight and landing. So they want them there as long as possible, and they want the cameras there because this belongs to not just the United States, it belongs to all the world. This is the first time mankind is leaving home and the first time we're arriving at a new world, our most ancient companion. And so they want it all documented. And Borman fights against it and fights against it. He loses that fight, and they tell him there will be four broadcasts, including number three, which will be heard and listened to by more people than have ever tuned in to a human voice in history.
Is that the Christmas broadcast?
That's Christmas Eve.
And how does that go?
Well, they give him these very detailed instructions about what to say. They tell him, say something appropriate, and that's it. And he laughs to this day, and he's got the best laugh you'll ever hear. And he says, can you imagine being told that today? Today, you go through 14 committees and 15 focus groups to the White House and copywriters. They just left it completely to the astronauts, and there was a struggle to figure out what to do. But they finally, with the help of some really concerned friends, including one woman who came up with the right idea at about 2:30 in the morning one night, right before the flight, they came up with what they believed would be the perfect thing to say to the world, not just the country, on Christmas Eve at the end of the worst year in our country's history.
What was that?
Well, they're up there and they're showing us a tour of the moon. And you can go on YouTube right now and watch this. It's incredibly dramatic. And they're showing us this is this crater and they're passing over this mountain. And with about 2 minutes left in the broadcast, they say, we have a message to wish to the world on this Christmas Eve. And Bill Anders begins to read the first lines from the book of Genesis, in the beginning. And one after another in Mission Control, these very serious scientific men start to be reduced to tears because they know what's being read. It is an origin story, our origin story. And it speaks to so many people in the world. And it doesn't speak to just one country or just one nation or one religion. It speaks to almost everyone. And it sees us all as one people at the end of this terrible year. So Anders reads his part, and then Lovell takes over, and finally Borman. And after Borman's done, people are sobbing all over the world, and Borman wishes people a Merry Christmas on the good earth, he says. And around the world, people stream out from their homes, from schools, from buildings, from taverns, all over the world, coming outside and looking skyward, hoping to catch a glimpse of this space capsule at the moon, knowing full well they're not going to see it, but looking all the same, because no one had ever been spoken to that way at that time as one.
I was just a boy when man landed on the moon. We were living in Hawaii. Everybody remembers where they were. And I remember my dad pointing up there and saying, they're up there now. Have we had a moment of awe like the Apollo mission since then?
I don't think we've come close. I mean, if you watched the launch of Falcon Heavy a couple months ago, it was stunning. It was an incredible feat of engineering, and you saw these retro rockets land themselves back on the pad. It looked like
in unison.
It looked like a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
But Hollywood could never create effects like the real thing, like we saw there. And yet, there's no sense that we're engaged in an existential battle and doing something that's never been done before, and that we've yearned to do for millennia since mankind walked the earth for the first time. So the stakes I don't think they'll ever be equaled quite the same way again.
The book is called Rocket Men, Robert Kurson's latest New York Times bestseller. You read Crashing Through, and if you haven't, you have to go back and read that too. You've written how many books?
This is my fourth.
Yeah, I know. It seems to, I thought it was four.
Yeah.
It would seem to me like there would be more, like maybe 50 or something like that. The bane of your existence must be finding those stories.
It's the scariest thing. That's what keeps a nonfiction writer up at night. And when you have a story like Apollo 8 and Rocket Men, which I consider, you know, one of the great stories in our country's history, it's hard to find one worthy as a successor.
And do people come up to you at cocktail parties and go, I got one. Tell the story about, and then it's not a good story.
All the time. And they really do give me good stories. They're good magazine stories usually. But
yeah, right. You need 350 pages,
right.
Don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, he's got one here, Rocket Men. Rocket Men, he'll be at LitFest. What day are you going to be there?
On Sunday.
Sunday.
I can't recall the time, but it's online.
Google litfest.org and check that out.